Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro, but as always, the show is never about me. It is who I have brought to you today, and I have brought two people here today from halfway around the world. We have two amazing Filipino game designers, artists, graphic designers, works in lots of different areas. We even talk about some magic realism, potentially. I would like to welcome to the show Cinta Posadas and Pamela Punzalin.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Woo-hoo. Yeah! Yeah!
That's us!
We did it! All right, interview over. No. So I am going to kick the can to Sin first, but would you both please introduce yourselves, because you'll do a much better job at it than I will.
Hey, my name is Sin. I am a queer, non-binary designer from Metro Manila, and I co-designed the game that we're going to be talking about today, Navatham Send. And before Navatham Send, I suppose a lot of people would know me from my plant game series. I also designed a number of other games that like kind of focus on love, intimacy, defiance, that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of that also reflects upon Navatham Send. Another thing that I do for the tabletop sphere is I do actually a lot of layout. I did some layout for Enoch's Wake, for Flirt Squad, for Gun and Slinger. So those are the two primary fields of design that I do in tabletop RPGs. That's me.
So I'm Pam, and I think a lot of people know me as the Dovetailer on Twitter, everywhere, really. Half the time I'm in Final Fantasy XIV these days because I like that world, but whenever I'm doing tabletop, I do design of my own. I'm also a perpetual freelance person for hire. I'm familiar with Forge in the Dark, Powered by the Apocalypse, a bit of OSR, and I recently did my first foray into D&D under Journeys Through the Radiant Citadel. I have also written for Hunter the Reckoning, and I have done work for Aspire, Thirsty Sword Lesbians, The Islands of Sinauna, and a whole bunch of other games. Mm-hmm. Beyond design, I am a editor, a sensitivity reader, and a cultural consultant. I also like doing community work with the likes of Asians Represent and pushing the hashtag RPGC, which is Role Playing Game Southeast Asia.
Beautiful. What do you play in Final Fantasy 14, Pam?
I main Dark Knight and Dragoon. I am a passable Astrologian and an abhorrent Red Mage, but I have touched every job, so...
You are not an abhorrent Red Mage.
I'm pretty
excuse me.
Do you also play Sin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one class. Just a dancer. That's it.
Beautiful. Paladin main myself, and then also White Mage.
Which data center are you in?
I have one is in Aether and the other is in Primal.
Dang it.
Yeah, we're in Crystal.
Well, data center travel is coming soon.
Yeah. Play with all the global friends.
Yes.
Yeah. We're in Crystal Balmung, by the way.
Heard. Very cool. Very cool. Well, maybe we'll talk about that later. But the big topic here, or we have a couple big topics here, but you know, the first and foremost that I want people to get interested in, if nothing else, is Navathun's End. So either one of you raise your hands. I can't see you, but would someone just care to give a brief description about what Navathun's End is?
So Navathun's End is a tabletop role-playing game where you play as agents trying to stop an apocalypse that nearly destroyed the world 800 years ago. It is a game that runs off of a kit-bash system between Forge in the Dark, Powered by the Apocalypse, and some elements of OSR. That's the elevator pitch. There you go.
Cool. That's very good. No, I've been able to read the game. If you haven't, is there like a quick start or something like that that people can pick up currently, or is that going to wait till more of No, it came out, right?
Yeah, it's out. It's out.
I don't know
on
what.
diwatamnl.itch.io.
Sorry, and every time I see the word Kickstarter in my notes, I'm like, it hasn't funded yet.
Actually, we funded in 2020.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. We founded in 2020 and we released recently. Yeah.
Awesome. And we'll also be getting the topics of like digital and print stuff too, but people can pick up copies of Navathun's End right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cool.
Yep.
So if you're listening to this, you know, we're not going to touch on every little detail in here. Go get the game. That's what that's for. Just go read the book. Links to that will be down below in the show notes. But I've had the opportunity to check out this game. It's been it's helped me with a lot of pieces of my design. And I think we have similar thoughts in some areas, and you've given me new thoughts in other ones. But the first thing I sort of want to ask, and either one of you can answer, you're sitting next to each other, which is unlike some of the other cooperative meetings that I have where they're at two different computers, but amongst yourselves, I would like one person to tell me what sort of narrative experience or like story experience you were trying to capture with writing Navathun's End. And then I would like another person to sort of talk about what you wanted the game to feel like mechanically in terms of that.
Oh, Pam's really good at talking about narrative experiences.
<Am I? laughs>
That you could say that she has real professional level advice when it comes to that kind of stuff. So go ahead.
I feel like what we were trying to accomplish with this game was showing the weight of legacy in fashion, right? Because like a lot of designers talk about this thing called gameable lore, but if you actually go out and Google it or search it on Twitter or whatever, you're not really going to see any consolidated resources on it. So how Sin and I like to define gameable lore is lore that is useful in a mechanical, systematic way for their players, which means that dates and timelines and stuff are nice, but if you can't make a character, a location, or a plot hook out of it, then ultimately it is useless. So, narratively, we wanted to have people create characters in a present that is deeply informed by a fragmented past. So that's kind of what we wanted from everything from our moves down to our, I guess, the premise that we gave. And mm-hmm. we wanted everything to be very open to interpretation. Like, we as co-designers decided that while we have a very set vision for us, what we're most interested in is kind of giving people the tools and going like, go wild. Like, that's why a lot of the descriptions are very fluid. And that's also why system-wise, Sin really tried to make a game that you could just take any rule that didn't work and toss it out or adjust whatever you want. Or you can arbitrate together as a playgroup rather than let like one person have the final say. So I guess that like kind of wraps up narratively what we wanted to do. Talk about legacy, talk about accountability, consequences, define hope for yourself, and also define the concept of hubris, because we were told in feedback that people found it interesting that we use the word hubris, because that usually bears the connotation of a bad thing. But for mm-hmm. us, it's hubris, that arrogance and that sheer vainglory that lets people survive. And that echoes mm-hmm. throughout the entire game.
Whoa, you immediately inspired me again. No, I told, just as a quick response that before we get over to Sin and mechanical stuff, get ready. I'm giving you a chance to formulate your answer. But you've inspired me because I think in a lot of the same terms of making like a gameable narrative or setting in terms of like legacy mechanics, right? Like lately I've been really fascinated by legacy style games like Risk Legacy, Betrayal on the Hill Legacy, all those sort of specific board game type, and how events in history, which are the game sessions you play, create a narrative of the next session and every session that came before it, so long as you're playing in the same sort of play group or whatever. And right. I think that is like, I've never been happy with the meandering campaign of like D&D or epic fantasy style stuff, because it all feels very like meandering. You're kind of just walking about doing either really gonzo adventures or you're doing like a super inflated epic narrative. And sometimes that sort of like fizzles out and you don't see the repercussions of that. I think a lot of the reasons why people like Critical Role in the recent set of years is because they're now seeing the impacts of their first campaign on all their other mm-hmm. campaigns. And they're like really invested in that. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how can we add that to our sort of, and Navathim's End is a big book, 200-ish pages, 230-ish pages.
Thereabouts.
Yeah. First of all, huge, huge claps, high fives to the both of you. I also want to make the big book game. So very cool. But that's all to say, to come back full circle, I think I want to say the word mechanics, but I don't think that's exactly what I mean by that. But legacy mechanics, for lack of a more refined term, mm-hmm. is a very cool consideration, especially as an innovation to the sort of epic fantasy genre, or like discover a new world genre of setting and RPG, right? I think that's all very, very cool. And you've immediately inspired me for my own game. So thank you.
It's interesting that you actually mention legacy mechanics, because Pendragon, the tabletop RPG, was actually one of my first games that I kind of stared at really long and tried to see what I could
apart.
Yeah. No kidding. The move Harness Hubris it went through several stages. It started from kind of in Pendragon they have something like a passion roll or something like that. Like if something really affects you, you can make a roll or something, or it affects your roll. That was something that I really liked. And I took it and I tried to kind of shape it for Navathim. And that's the whole concept of like hubris here in Navathim, where you are spurned on by your determination to create a future, even if you don't get to see it. That's the whole kind of thing that I took from Pendragon. And with like the whole legacy thing, and the campaigns extending. That's actually another thing that we really wanted for Navathim. I am personally very used to long campaigns.
I think we both
whenever,
are.
Yeah, we both are.
Yeah.
Whenever I play in a campaign that's like, it only lasts a couple of months, I get really sad. Because I get super attached to my characters. Uh-huh. And I get super attached to NPCs. And when a game inevitably comes to an end, because all games do, I get really sad and lonely. I get like the equivalent of a con drop. So I just never wanted to end. So when we designed Navathim's End, we really wanted to have a system that could support long-term play and could support, I guess, like legacy play, in that you play like your characters maybe go on for maybe 10 years of their life, and then you pick up the campaign again. You play a bunch of characters who were inspired by your characters of old, because Navathim itself, from its very beginning, has actually seen 3 campaigns, and a lot of the history, the lore history in the book itself, were basically based off and inspired by what happened during those campaigns. Like, the Mockingbird era was actually the campaign right before the campaign I'm running right now. And the Times of Chaos was also a little bit inspired by the campaign that I ran beforehand. So, yeah. And because I do have a really high exposure to Forge in the Dark and Powered by the Apocalypse games, I just took, like, the parts, or we took the parts that, like, really kind of resonated with me and resonated with the concept of what we wanted Navathim to be. Especially for Forge in the Dark, like, Pan was incredible with that, because she has a lot of, like, grasp of those sorts of mechanics. So we kind of put our brains together to kind of create this sort of game that hopefully doesn't do the thing that you just talked about, like the whole meandering thing. Yeah.
The other interesting thing, though, about it, like, if we talk purely system, is the majority of Forge in the Dark games and Powered by the Apocalypse games do not support long play. They are really built to be done in seasons.
Like
five sessions, or like maybe 15 with like 3 different seasons. So it's almost like TV-like in its format, or they're meant to be episodic, kind of like how a lot of Blades in the Dark runs, where it's supposed to be a drop-in, drop-out, low-commitment thing. But that, I guess, was a design challenge for us. As Sin put it, being used to long campaigns, we wanted to see what we could define as longevity, while also providing people the room to just say, okay, we can cut it off here and we're all happy and just do something else, or take whatever we wanted from the last campaign and put it back in. We didn't really, there wasn't a lot of time, I think, to really explore that for us, but hopefully, like, energy and emotion allowing, we might be able to make more supplements in that direction.
Oh, yeah. There's so many things I want to make. I just don't have the money.
Same.
I don't have funding.
I feel it. I'm over here trying to make a goddamn deck builder. And I'm like, how do I get all these little cards?
Oh, but a thing that I also want to explore very soon is to actually release, what do you call them again?
Which one?
Those licenses, so that people can do whatever they want.
Oh, like an open source.
Yeah. I've been trying to study.
An SRD, there you go.
I've been trying to study how to make a proper SRD that will allow people to make things for Navathim without them having to worry about copyright. Because I don't want that. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna sue people for making stuff for Navathim. Like, heck, I'd be so honored. And I want them to be able to, if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I always think about, for me, whenever I've GM'd some longer campaigns, I've always thought about, like, what are the repercussions of people's actions, not only in the short term, but in the long term as well.
Right.
And just as, like, an example of how you've inspired me here today and kind of, like, allowing that to apply maybe to someone else who's listening. I'm working in, like, a science fantasy setting, and the world are these two progenitor mech, very Xenoblade inspired.
Okay.
And, you know, one mech is laying in the sea, half destroyed by the other mech, who's plunged a giant blade into it, like a knight over, like, kneeling or something like that.
Ooh, that's cool.
And they're both Sounds connected. Metal. It's super sick. At least I think so. But it's my thing, so. But they're connected by the swords. The sword's like an elevator. But the legacy part that you inspired me by is, I think would be really fascinating, is part of the narrative is about discovery and getting inside of the mechs. You know, they have like access panels and stuff. And so the cultures that sort of gestate on top of the mech over the course of, you know, miraculous energy and blah, blah, blah. And we don't need to explain it, suspension of disbelief. But when you go inside and like you do like a dungeon, quote unquote, part of the mech will move, and you could like kill thousands of people, or like you could unlock new areas on the mech, so like it boots up for a second, an arm moves, and now you have like a new location to explore, like the underside of an arm, right, or something like that.
Sounds rad.
Yeah,
I want that.
Yeah, you made it happen, so you can have it.
Well, I hope I get to read it soon.
Yeah, soon probably not, but you're more than welcome to talk about it on the Discord for sure. But yeah, so let's talk about why I know that you have certain expertises in Forge in the Dark and PBTA games, and as you mentioned, slightly OSR. But what exactly did you like from those systems, and what were you trying to marry together with Navathems, and how do you think that helps with the sort of, how do I want to say this, the setting experience or narrative experience you're trying to culminate in this game?
Do you want me to start? Or okay, well, the first one outright is the playbook system from PBTA, which is, it I guess is the easiest way for us to create the equivalent of like classes, right? Which gives people like a comfort zone, and it also helped us kind of like tie it in through the narrative of these agent designations are actually fields of specialization that are inspired by the Core 7, like the heroes of old. So like lore-wise, that's how it ties in. But mechanically, we wanted kind of a way to present like playbooks in a familiar kind of comfortable way, and to be able to also like put forward some familiar tropes in play. So like, just to be more concrete about it, so like you have your command, which is one of our agent designations, and like the command is kind of like your, I mean, it's in the name, right? He's kind of like the
you know what you're getting.
Yeah. He's kind of like the leader, or they kind of, they call the shots, and you can see it in their skills, the roster of skills, and like it just kind of translates. And then you have the weapon, who is, I suppose their trope is more like they know how to do fighting really well, like they can have really good command when it comes to fighting. So like the command could be good at fighting, but they could also not. But the weapon for sure would be good at fighting, but the weapon could also be good at doing the command's job, especially if the weapon gets like skills from the command playbook. And that's like another thing we wanted to do. While we wanted to create a comfortable place for people to play the type of tropes and stereotypes that they wanted, we also wanted to give people a lot of customization options by allowing multi-classes, introducing a magic class system, and allowing for like veterancy skills and all of that stuff, and other ways of advancement. We wanted to really kind of allow people to sit in a comfortable, familiar space with the playbook mechanics, but also to change it in that you can customize yourself in
blocks,
a lot of ways.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
To kind of make it your own versus.
That was like one of our first design pieces.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah. I think also we wanted to figure out how moves would work for us, because there has been discourse before about how the Powered by the Apocalypse concept of a move is not actually precise enough for the system that it belongs to. So how we wanted to structure moves was that they are narrative entry points in which both failure and success could be interesting. So that's why we had our dice system where you can fail, but you can also fail by succeeding too well. So that's a thing. Then we wanted to balance that out with a synergy of skills, wherein if you have a system, if you possess a particular skill, you can bend the system, manipulate it, or change the rules using those skills. So that's like the two, that's like the second big part of it. So like the point was to create versatility and customizability, and to emphasize that every part of our system can be moved around as you need, and that they build a building, but you can change the floors and change the decor inside, and it's not going to change the game itself. And there's no such thing as breaking the game either.
Yeah, there's so many. I totally vibe with this, because it's one of the reasons why I sort of like shy away from D&D 5th edition and D&D light games, is because, you know, once you pick barbarian or whatever have you, you're kind of that. You don't really get to do much else with that. You're like, oh, but you get to pick subclasses, cool, but I'm still gonna swing with my giant, you know, great axe because or great sword because it's mechanically optimal, and etc. Except, listen, I'm the power gamer. I'll bring a monkey, you know what I mean?
I get it.
But you know, I really vibe with the lateral movement you can have with the character you create, because we're in this really interesting generation. There's a really interesting article that Ava Islam shared with me a long while back about the different generations of play culture. And the one we're sort of currently in is the like original character concept culture, or like OC culture for short. And it's just this idea. And by no means is this article meant to like segment people into buckets, but there is this trend of people getting really attached to the characters they create. So far flung from the OSR where like your character is expendable, or it's like a resource of the world or whatever have you. And people get fan art for their characters that kind of give them their own legacy and all of those pieces. And so I really think that this lateral design or customizable design is like a almost a transient response to what people like to play as nowadays. They love playing D&D because they feel like D&D is a system where they can sort of like coat whatever they want on top of the metrics of the system. You know, how many different ways can you slice a paladin in all its subclasses and still have like a ton of different really cool concepts when it comes to creating characters.
I like the fact that somebody attempted to make a descriptive exercise on the fact that I think our current generations of playgroups have accepted the idea that it is okay to do whatever the hell you want with your design and your table for so long as people consent to it. Because when I was a lot younger in tabletop, and I know I sound like an old lady right now, but like when when I was first playing, like people used to be very defensive about stuff like Mary Sue's and Gary Stu's and standing out and not fitting the bill, right? But you have an increase of visible queer players and people who are learning that neurodivergence and disability and different forms of how life stress changes you with trauma, that's a thing now. And it really does come out in collaborative setups like tabletop, where everybody accepts that, one, your players and their characters are competent, two, they are owned by you, and three, mm-hmm. the collective ownership of the table and the game in your hands will only succeed if everybody converses with each other and accepts those individual mm-hmm. perspectives and intersections. So, mm-hmm. like, it's no longer about succeeding mechanically. Mm-hmm. Like, if you wanted that experience, then cool, that's your thing. I'm not going to yuck your yum. But if you don't want that certain thing, how then do you build design that is friendly to that? So it's a big preoccupation of mine personally, because like I am a woman and I am very, very gay. Mm-hmm. So, and I have suffered the full gamut of being called not a good gamer and not a good mm-hmm. RPer because I did not fit the T. So mm-hmm. usually when you're in that position, what ends up happening is you tell yourself, God damn it, I'm just going to build my own shit. You know, mm-hmm. versus trying to fit into a system that just won't work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Love it. Big hearts for sure. I also, double you've inspired me. I don't know if this is going to go into my particular game, but the mm-hmm. the fact that you can, I love that you worked on both extreme ends of your dice system, right? You gain yeah. experience by failing yeah. and you gain experience by over succeeding, because I've always thought that you don't just learn from your failures. You also very much learn from your successes in real yeah. life, right? Like, yeah. oh, that worked. Uh-huh. So then, like, I can do it again, right? I can repeat that. Mm-hmm. And that is experience. So I think that's very cool. And I also like the thought of how that quote-unquote successive failure is also, like, narratively an overextension, right? Like, yeah. you've extended mm-hmm. yourself beyond a comfortable point that you put yourself at risk.
You pushed yourself a little. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's super sick. I think that's really smart. And I think that that is something that PBTA/Forge in the Dark is missing. I think that they need those sort of, I think actually probably most dice games need something that happens at the top end that isn't just like more success, right?
Yeah.
I guess
yeah.
it's on the genre. Yeah. Speaking of success,
we also tried to make it narratively important yeah. through mm-hmm. the threads.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have like a huge D100 table of threads that a lot of your overshoots will have you roll on that table. And there's mm-hmm. like, they're not always bad.
Yeah, there could be anything yeah. from, well, shit, your mission was apparently a problem for somebody else's mission.
Yeah.
To mm-hmm. your ex is in town, what are you going to do? Right?
Yeah. It can be completely related to the mission you just did, or something completely out of the blue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm projecting here, but the character origins bits is, so you were talking a little bit earlier about how you wanted very customizable characters. Mm-hmm. And did you like rip out vices and stuff and put them into the character origins? Because that's what the quirks feel like.
Kind
it feels
of.
Like vice or obligation style things. And you've also attached them to the experience questions that would typically go on a Forge in the Dark
yeah.
playbook.
Yeah, thanks for catching that.
Yeah, yeah. That was,
we've not actually had a lot of people,
they have
realized
not
that.
People
who
I notice these things. People also tend to forget that like there were a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse games, I think like second gen or third gen, that tried to do the overshoot thing. But I do remember that. Yeah, it sort of fell to the wayside. Like, my own personal design tried it before with a game that I call Sundo. And so that's S-U-N-D-O. It's a Filipino word for the ghost that literally picks you up when
it's
you
psychopomp.
Die. It's a psychopomp.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when I did my overshoot there, that was kind of like a prototype for what I tried to help Sid with in Netathem, where I was like, mm-hmm. these overshoots really have to be narratively compelling. And they also have to be a consensual thing. Like,
yeah.
it's okay to decide as a player that you don't want to overshoot, you want to redo
yeah.
that. because mm-hmm. we're both very strong believers in choice when it comes to tabletop, because that is literally one of the only things that can make a tabletop game very compelling. Because in a video game, when you screw up, you have to reset and go to a save point, right? Mm-hmm. And like the system mm-hmm. itself is not going to change. There's going to be some RNG and whatever, but you're still going to have to do the thing. In tabletop, you can completely say, no, let's just erase the last 3 hours and start again. So the more
bolting. That was all a dream.
Yeah, it was all a dream. It didn't happen, right? And mm-hmm. for us, that's like super important, because you're dealing with human people. Not everybody is initially okay with the idea of failure mm-hmm. or even the idea of consequence, and that's totally fine. I know that some mm-hmm. people think that spoils their fun, but like if your table doesn't like it, then they should reserve the right to rewind the story mm-hmm. and find some kind of systematic or narrative compromise.
Yeah, that's why yeah. we have the wind back mm-hmm. In the game. Like, we wanted to give all the players on the table, including the GM, a chance to kind of say, that didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's rewind.
Do that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's Prince of Persia it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh my god, again. Prince of Persia.
Everyone just got sent back.
I haven't heard that in a while.
Yeah, I think that it's so interesting that you allow sort of like an opt out. Right?
Yeah.
Because I think that, in my experience, I have seen players that give like the okay thumbs up to when we're talking about like setting up a campaign of a particular game, and the narrative is like a horror pushing or kind of like hopelessness pushing, like a grimdark sort of thing. And they're like, yeah, I'm cool with character death, as they twiddle their thumbs underneath the table. Like, maybe yeah. I'm okay with that. And then it comes push to shove, right? And they're like, wait, no, I want nothing bad to happen to my sweet Thomas. I think it's important that you have, it's almost like a lot of time in this moment, I would even consider like flashback, wind back, or like opt outs as safety tools developed yeah. for those styles of games, right? Like,
yeah. Yep.
In an earlier episode of this podcast, I spoke with Seb Pines, who created the game Dwellings, which is sort of like a choose your own adventure style game. Mm-hmm. But they created a specific safety mechanic that was very like visceral and artifact based. So the game is horror based. It has some like, it potentially has some like content warning trauma pieces in it, like the orc that mm-hmm. could attach different traumas. So as you're flipping through the book, you have two pieces of artifacts for you. One is the keyhole,
mm-hmm.
which is this big mm-hmm. piece of paper or cardboard that actually fits into the book. And so if you're starting to read a piece of fiction that you're not like vibing with, you can put that keyhole over. And the sort of like idea of is it's a safety tool. You have to unlock that when you want to go through it. Cause the dwelling is like in a house. It's like a horror house sort of narrative. And so mm-hmm. if you ever go back to that page, you can peek into the keyhole and be like, oh, that's what this was. Do I want to go in there yet? No, I don't need to go in there right now. And then you can keep continuing through the book. So it's like this little, you can remind yourself what was there before you take the slat the next step to go through it. And the other one is a bookmark that is a key. And so if you're feeling uncomfortable or need to process something in the book, you put the key in as the bookmark. And then when you're ready to unlock the book again, you take the key out. So it's like this sort of like visceral or verisimilitude style safety tool that I found really interesting. Yeah, we talked a lot about, you know, we're seeing a really big precedence on safety tools being written into games. But a lot of people, and I think the X card and stuff has done its job in like creating a beginning acceptable space for safety tools. But we talked mm-hmm. a lot about in that episode of like, well, do you actually need to craft like custom safety tools for your particular game, its particular genres? The X card isn't always going to work at a table. In fact, one situation I always recommend when people say like, oh, I want to write the X card into my game. Something you have to understand is that not everyone has the strength or confidence to reach across the table, grab the X card and hold it up in a group of like six strangers, especially at like conventions and stuff. So like mm-hmm. it's really hard to engage with the X card when you're under that sort of pressure, right? Or yeah. the rewind system, what's it called? Script change, I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, we've already crossed the line on that one, right? Mm-hmm. Like we've already seen like the potential traumatic conditions. If someone again is not like emotionally aware enough mm-hmm. of themselves or have like enough self-awareness to see something coming,
right.
Like, oh, we're building up to this thing that I don't like. We need to stop here. It could mm-hmm. already go, right? We can't like take back what we say or what we describe. Some you could probably take a moment and step away from the table or whatever have you. But basically, this is all to say that like the safety tools that a lot of people are relying on for their games in the current generation, I guess we'll say, are these X cards, script change, all these things. But I also think it's a little bit of a, I don't want to be mean, but the word, I'm not trying to be mean, but the word I'm using is sort of laziness. It's like this...
Right.
There are these tools that exist. Everyone has accepted them. I'm just going to slap them into my game and not think anymore about
right.
it.
Right? Yeah. Okay, so okay. It's like not precise okay. enough.
Yeah.
It's,
yes, exactly. Yeah. Precision. Yeah. Thank you. That's a much better term.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of criticism about it because I did have some conversations with like John Stravopoulos about, mm-hmm. about script change and other things. And the general sense is that the problem with not seriously thinking about consent and the tools at your table mm-hmm. is that people are not using them they're not really using them as tools for assistance. They're hoping that they'll just be band-aids on shotgun wounds.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
in a
they're more like cop-outs.
Yeah. Like you're, but the thing is, they're there to like, they're there to regulate things, but they're not there to just automatically go, this game is safe. Like you yeah. have to mm-hmm. foster the environment of safety and consent. You have to mm-hmm. figure out the gaps in your own design that may create room for problems. Because like, I'm a personal believer in the idea that there's no such thing as a universal good or bad. And there's also no such thing as like good people and bad people. They're just consistent actions towards bad stuff or good stuff. Like, so if mm-hmm. you put that in, like, I feel like if you keep that in mind, then you understand that sometimes the grossest violations of safety are done without awareness at all, and mm-hmm. that'll bleed into your design. So if you understand that, then that should make you a lot more careful with developing precisely the tools that you can do for people, and also developing this thing that one of my other designer friends likes talking about, which is post-traumatic care in a way. Like, mm-hmm. what do you do to recover after something like that, because we don't have enough tools for that either. How do you regain your sense of aftercare? Yeah. Like, you don't, how do you regain your sense of self after? How do you return to a place of good faith and trust in
and intent? How do you stop the bleed?
Yeah,
how or do you stop not the bleed? Even yeah. stop the bleed. How do you manage the bleed?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, there like, another. Go ahead.
Speaking from personal design. And as a player experience, when I was a player and I didn't quite understand the concept of consent yet, mm-hmm. in like my early, early days of playing, there was this thing I used to do where I would pretend that I was getting a call during parts of the game where like I'd be getting a little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like I'd get my phone and then I'd put it to my ear and be like, hello, hello. Like fucking Academy Award goes to, right? And I go out to like somewhere else. Like I remove myself from the table. I excuse myself. I go somewhere and I fake a conversation. And I just kind of like take this time to calm myself down. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't actually until I was going to be a player at Pam's game where I talked about that as if it was normal, as if it wasn't a bad thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
And very adamantly, Pam was like, there's no doing that in my table. Like, she was trying to basically make sure, and this was before Pam and I were even anything. Like, we weren't mm-hmm. dating yet at the time. She told me, and she was trying to make sure that if there is anything making you uncomfortable, that she will be there to kind of like talk it out, or like we can take a break, it's okay to ask for a break. And that was personally so revolutionary to me at the time, having come from tables where they just keep going on whether you left the table or not, right? Yeah. So moving forward from that, when I started designing Navithim, because Pam was my editor and my co-designer, and so I'd have like little parts at the beginning of the whole thing where there'd be little design notes of like, by the way, if you're gonna do this part, please be aware of people's triggers, etc., etc. And I do genuinely believe I put that in way too many parts of the text because I was so nervous about like people taking on like concepts of like being war torn or like, because we have one origin here called Child of the Upheaval. I remember like we had to revise that so many times. Because the concept of Navithim and its history is that it's very,
there's a lot of conflict.
It's not born and rooted in conflict, but there's it exists. Like real life. Right. Our origin, Child of an Upheaval, is supposed to be referencing the rather tumultuous history of Navithim, where while Navithim itself is not born out of, while conflict is not the be-all end-all of Navithim, it does exist. And I wanted to make sure, and I was really trying really hard to make sure that people would not turn this into trauma porn, poverty porn, or war porn, because I'm quite strongly against that, honestly. Like, I always say that I like writing stories about defiance and revolution and rebellion, but that's also not people's license to turn it into their, I guess, trauma fantasy or war fantasy or something like that. I mean, I'm sure lots of people will take whatever they want and play it however they want. But within the text of Navithim, I wanted to make sure that that came across. And I'm pretty sure I had to like really kind of hold my hand when it came to writing that part. I think Child of an Upheaval went through like maybe 3 or 4 changes before it finally was what it was. Because it took me a while. Like, it was the last origin that I really kind of like nailed it down. But
it's so hard. There are definitely genres that I want to explore and talk about and use as like jumping off points, but it's so easy to do a poor job at getting people set up for that. And I'm talking about me. I'm not talking about anyone in particular. I'm talking about myself. You know, I don't know what it's like to be in war. I don't watch a lot of war stories. I don't read a lot of war stories. I don't, you know, I haven't seen any interviews. I can understand that war is hell at the surface level of it, just as an example.
Right.
Or how to do horror right, or even how to do like epic fantasy in a way that isn't trite and you know, what I would find.
Colonial?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes, there is. What am I looking for in this one? Very like conquering mindset or like assimilation based or whatever have you. Like,
or white hero.
Listen, there is not one time from me deciding that I'm against the greater European patriarchy that every single one of my characters will be bald or dreaded and have dark sea skin. Like, there's no way you're gonna get me to play anything. If dwarves don't aren't usually that, I don't give a fuck. My elf, dreads and hot black, dude. But yeah, I can understand the care you both took in presenting certain origin backgrounds, because, and you know, any character creation piece, because those are going to inform role play, right? Like these quirks, these experience questions, the magic that you choose, the seven that you choose to have sort of like a legacy from, all of those are going to play into helping someone wrap their head around the setting and make role play decisions, at least from the rip, until they develop their own sort of more refined choices.
Yeah.
I love it. It's so good. It's so great.
Thank you.
I also really like, just as the last bit of, actually, no, no, because we're at the, we're like the 50 minute mark here. And I know you two are up. You're going late on this one, and Pants are already at work tomorrow. So I want to move in. Listen, I care. We're going to sort of move into, we could go forever about Navathim Zen, which just means you have to go buy it, get it, read it, absorb it, realize the cool design. Yeah, you kind of have to do that. You don't get to hear any more about it here. But if you're curious, you should definitely check it out. But there are a couple of extra topics that we wanted to get into today. One of the bigger ones first presented is digital versus print. So we talked about earlier that you can get Navathim's End, at least digitally, and talking about the what are your thoughts on the digital print landscape as we continue to innovate on different ideas?
Well, the reality of it, and I'll be super harsh, is that the Philippine side in particular lives and dies on digital copies. Mm-hmm. We do not have inherent means of efficiently mass producing books down here.
We just don't have publishers.
And we do not have publishers at all. Furthermore, shipping between Southeast Asian countries is absolute hell. Like, I know that whenever I talk to people from abroad, they're like, yeah, it's pretty bad over here. And I'm like,
are you sure?
Oh, you sure about that?
Yeah, someone in Cleveland complaining about like 20-minute traffic. Have you been to San Francisco, brother? Have you been to Los Angeles? You're in a 3-hour commute. You don't know anything about traffic.
And like, it's the same with Philippines, because like, for example, I have friends in Malaysia and Indonesia, and none of us want to ship to each other.
Yep.
It's more efficient for us to literally ship to somebody in the States and have that person from the States ship back to us than it is to ship. Yeah, that's how bad it is.
You have to triangulate your shipping?
Yes, we have to triangulate our shipping across an ocean.
Because our post offices just do not talk to each other.
They don't.
What happens is your mail is going to get lost, and then when it finally arrives in the place where it's supposed to go, it's going to get blocked by customs, and they're going to make you pay inordinate amounts of money because of the quote-unquote hassle that they had
that you put them through for holding on to your
stuff. That's how it goes.
So physical is just not possible for us, right? And it was honestly, I'm going to use the word heartbreaking, but the other word I'd use is kind of rage-inducing, that like a lot of people immediately retracted support during our Kickstarter funding period because they learned that we do not have physical copies. Sin got a lot of that.
People going,
I can't pay you because you don't have a physical copy of your game.
Yeah, they just walked away. It was pretty sad.
Yeah, and that sucks. Because I'm going to be that bitch in the room and say my game is awesome.
Yeah.
And like, since my game is awesome, since our game is awesome, like, what about everybody else who is on par with us design-wise, and even better than us in many cases design-wise? Like, are you just going to say no to what they have to offer just because you can't hold a dead tree copy of their work?
And honestly, what particularly bothered me is Navathim was kickstarted with three big projects and a zine of smaller projects. Typically, in a Kickstarter, you only get one project, right? So people who walked away from backing Navathim's End during the Kickstarter campaign also walked away from backing all those other projects. So it wasn't just us who suffered, you know? And that just sucks. But just because we couldn't produce print cup, they just walked away. And the thing about that is, the truth of print is that the countries that make it so essential, like the US and the UK, are adhering to inherently white biases.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. It's very old white boomer to want a physical thing when none of us really play face to face anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that too, right? And like I've seen a lot of very innovative design. Like the kind of design that makes me go, why the fuck did I not think about that?
Mm.
From designers who knew that they wanted their game to not be in print. They wanted to use chat rooms. They wanted to mm-hmm. use Roll20. They wanted to play on frigging
Discord.
Discord or on like Google Meet or something. Like they made games out of that. Mm. So that level of innovation is something that people who are biased towards print are denying. I'm not saying uh-huh. that print is bad. What I'm saying is we need to expand our thinking mm-hmm. if we want mm-hmm. to diversify our spaces, because like it's also economically friendly to diversify in that direction, because not everybody is going to have the capability to produce 200 plus upwards of books, right? Mm-hmm. And
you're locking out a lot of people.
You're locking out a lot of people. And like it's not, you're not just locking out like us. A lot of the creators I know who are also in the UK and are also in America, you're wishing hell upon them by insisting uh-huh. that they post all of these friggin' books and send them through the mail and pay out of their nose for that stuff while demanding expert AAA quality
uh-huh.
of which we cannot produce, and that's okay. Like because like, the inherent bias, as I see it here, is everybody's demanding a AAA product without understanding the amount of work, time, and energy that it does to create those. It's almost like people are not allowed to make mistakes if you are not D&D.
Right. And the additional ironic part about that, they demand AAA, but the moment you price your books
AAA,
higher than,
not gonna buy it for you. Yeah,
higher than like $20,
yep.
they won't buy it.
They won't buy it.
Like, put your money where your mouth is, god dang it.
What do you want here?
What do you want?
It's a running meme of, am I a joke to you?
do people know how many people we have to manage when we make products like that? In Navathem alone, and it's a small project compared to like a lot of other projects.
Yeah.
I had to manage seven artists. I don't know. I had to manage a lot of artists.
And technically, mm-hmm. if we wanted to meet the kind of punitive standards people wanted, then I should not have been editor, nor should mm-hmm. I have been the sensitivity person, which would have added at least 2 to 5 other people to the docket. Mm-hmm. Then we already had a layout artist who was a friend of ours, and he was very generous in saying, like, hey, I'm going to lay out your entire book. If Paladin had not done that, that meant that Sin would have had to lay out it on top of doing all the design work and on top of listening to my edits, right?
Crying. Crying, sobbing, and puking Navathem for the next few months. And it was so funny, too. I randomly tweeted it. I was like, do I have the money to hire a layout artist? Of which, like, I tweeted immediately after, who the heck am I kidding? I don't have that money.
No, I don't.
Like, if I were a person, like, looking at my portfolio, I wouldn't afford me. You know?
Same. I can't afford me.
I can't afford me.
Damn.
Where are we going to go? That's existential, if anything.
And that's another thing. This is something that I remember me and BJ Rensho talked about before.
Uh-huh.
If us Filipinos hired each other at our current rates, because we're pricing ourselves according to international standards, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If us Filipinos hired each other on the current rates that we have according to international standards, none of us would be able to hire each other.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford it. Because our cost of living here is ridiculous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Contrary to popular belief, it is not cheap to live here. It's obviously quote unquote cheaper to live here than it is to, let's say, live in the States.
New York or whatever.
But sure. If you're still based here, it's still very expensive.
right?
You're fighting for space all the time.
Yeah, it's a lot. The print thing is always going to like wake up a lot of feelings in designers here, as will rates. And as will the whole argument that you have to charge your worth, so to speak. People expect you to charge your worth, but they won't pay for you. Yeah. So it's like, what do you want from me?
My best example of this is always Pam's own experience when they went to BBC. Pre-BBC, we had to help her get a bunch of people's games and put them in, like, print them all. And basically put them in her suitcase and have her somehow manage to market all of those games on her own in a hectic con. Yeah. And like the fact that we have to do that.
I had a suitcase and a backpack full of print of upwards of 13 designers.
And we had to introduce the concept of creating QR codes for every single designer that would like give their games to us. You had to generate upwards of like 30.
I got paper cuts and I broke a stapler.
Yeah. Exactly. You broke an expensive stapler.
I broke an expensive. Yeah. I'm still crying over that.
The thing about that is how much of that reflected back to the rest of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did we get more attention, RPGC, as a whole and as general? Yeah, we did. And we're kind of on the map, quote unquote, because people know the hashtag, people know creators from our place. But I would argue that the fact that Pam had to break her back at a convention for that, when she could have used that to market herself, to get for herself, it's just, you know, it's a little unfair that people can just waltz into, like, people from there in the States can just waltz into the said con and do what they want and not have to worry about the suitcase and the backpack and whether the games have been sold and whether word has been sent out. It feels like we have to throw all of our bargaining chips just to have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
Why has that not changed years later?
Yeah, that's a heartbreaking thing.
You know, like, we're all still trying to throw all of our chips at the table. And it's hard. It's heartbreaking. And we're at a point where sometimes you look at the community and you hope that some people will make it, that they will have their own initiative to also push forward and find opportunities. And then whenever opportunities do present themselves, you kind of pass it along and see if they get hired too, if maybe word will spread that there's more than just, I don't know, 5 people in RPGC. That's the whole thing, right? Like, that's the whole point of a movement and like a community. You want to shine the light on everybody. You want to make multiple tables. You want to make sure that everybody gets supported. But it's just so hard. It's just not the case sometimes because for some reason, the centers of the tabletop sphere right now do not trust you unless they meet you face to face. And that's a cruel reality.
Or have a product physical.
Or that your product is physical.
Yeah, it has to be physical.
And that's a cruel reality that a lot of us smaller designers have to face because
that's just how they
that's
play
just how it is. And sometimes you have to kind of swallow the fact that your passport will not be powerful enough to bring you to those centers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that your day job will just not generate enough money to pay for the ticket to bring you to those centers. And it's just a lot. Like, if I really went into all of it, would be here forever.
Well, it's, first of all, I'm highly dampened by all this. And this is not new to me. I've had actually quite a few Filipino guests on the show so far, and also some Malaysian guests. You know, me personally, Jeremy Gage, is very aware of like the state of affairs when it comes to print and digital for the different sectors of the globe. And, you know, for the people that are like, well, I like to have a nice book in my hand, you can eat my whole ass, dude. we're quickly moved. We have a tiny computer in our pocket, right? And apps are getting more sophisticated every day.
My phone is smarter than me.
Yeah, my phone legitimately is smarter than I am. You know, it feels like I don't want to learn how to use TikTok. I don't want to learn how to use Adobe. I don't want to learn how to use Affinity Public. Gosh. All the conversations that are these, like, I have to have a print book. I can't read off like a digital screen or something like that. Or like use it, right? Because I think people feel like, oh, if I have a physical book, I can flip to pages or whatever, or I can bookmark them and stuff. If you had learned the power of Kindle or the book app, and I can only speak for Apple because I'm in the garden. Like, there are highlight tools, bookmarking tools. You can write up your own documents in God blessed Google Docs or Obsidian and backlink yourself or use Notion or whatever. Like. Yeah. First of all, on the digital front, just to talk like, not just to be like a doomsayer along with this conversation, and that's not to dismiss or belittle the plight that everyone is going through when it comes to this conversation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what does Navathim's End look like if you designed a Notion template with like backlinking and stuff like that, and that you sold that as a part of like a QR code or something in the game, right? I think there are some, like, in this conversation of digital versus print, I think there's some extra like accessible tools that we can look at to redefine the quote unquote PDF, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of people that complain about that print versus digital in the for print team, I think it feels like too much of a headache for them. Because when you have a physical book, right, I'm going to pick up one in my hand just so I can talk through what I'm going through.
Sure, sure.
You know, I know, like, I have Band of Blades in my hand. I know that the broken sits somewhere in the first third of the book, like just off the rip. So I can open up to the first third and do that, right? Just
more
physically
or less find
it. Yeah, and find a way to find it. And in digital, you know, I know there's a table of contents. Don't even fucking get me started.
Or,
you know, someone's like, go ahead.
You can control F.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Oh, there you go. See, but you know, people don't know about control F. For real, you would be surprised. With the eyes that I see light up in my own play, you're like, yeah, you can just control F on your computer. Like, what is that? What is happening?
What is that?
Holy shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But what I'm essentially pointing to is a lack of wanting to adapt and learn or evolve along with the play space, right? It's the traditionalism. It's the analog. It's the, you know, digital. We could have a conversation about whether or not print or digital is cheaper, right? You could say digital is cheaper, but like there's the cost of a computer and an internet subscription. And like
there
are certain facilitations that digital requires to exist, right? But I will say, and also those materials may not be good for the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We could talk ad nauseum about it. But there are people who can't facilitate print, as you've described here today, right? And I do think there is definitely a consideration, and there are people making small strides in those directions. We look at the new virtual tabletops that are being created with, like, Roll and Astral and, what was that? Arcane something?
Oh, I've never heard of that. Okay.
Yeah, it's a really new one. But, you know, people are trying to figure out, like, how do we make a tabletop simulator, obviously, and there are tools, they take some learning, and nothing is easier than just like coming to a table with a book and being able to like improv that stuff, right? And write on index cards. Just everyone feels like it's a little bit more or a little less finicky, a little less friction. Some people think that it's easier for them to like transcribe that stuff with their body rather than the tool they're using, right? So I think that's part of that
conversation. Can I cut in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
That's really funny to me because all my years of playing D&D, for example, of which I played, I think, a good number of years, I've never once owned a physical copy of the Player's Handbook.
Same.
And it's all PDFs in my phone. And I actually used to rely on a lot of apps, like the Spellbook app.
Oh, yeah.
That's available on Google Play, something like that. And like a character sheet app or something. Like everything was digital. And
everyone uses D&D Beyond, right?
Yeah. And when I was DMing too, I'd have like a soundboard on my phone, like all of that stuff. Everything was digital. The only thing that was analog was dice, but you could have dice rollers too. Yeah.
People don't trust them.
Yeah. My players were pretty superstitious.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, my experience with tabletop has always been digital. So this insistence on physical is so, it's not like it's a stranger thing to me. I understand it. Like, I too want to rub the physical book of Navathan's End on my cheek and smell the book, you know, I get it, but to require it of designers is nothing short of shutting the gate and throwing away the key.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree. It's
like, personally, I really want to make an app for Navathan's End, like a character sheet app.
Yeah.
And just kind of like have them, you know, but like making an app is, I don't know how to do that.
I wish.
React,
yeah, I wish.
And I don't think I have the money.
We do not.
To pay somebody.
No, it's expensive.
For sure.
Like, I don't know how much money of a Kickstarter I'd have to, like, set the goal for an app.
6 digits minimum.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's right.
For sure. Yeah, I definitely think that, like, there are ways to provide, like, a really ease of use. You know, I've had other people on the show who talk about PDF is not the optimal digital support file format. There's a lot of other more accessible, like, EPUB formats and things like that. And also, like I mentioned earlier, the whole, just Notion is the only example I can think of where you could type it up, sell it as a template on like Gumroad or something. People could have it, and it has a bunch of backlinking resources, and you can write inside of it and stuff like that. But I think there are some additional digital tools that we can use out there when it comes specifically to the games market of how to sell books, like rewriting what a book is, right? PDF was sort of like the first transition of like, oh, a book can be digital, right? But what else can the book or the game be put into or use, right? And I think of a lot of these backlinking research tools like Obsidian, Research Rome, Notion, God Blessed. Can't remember the other one. Is it Bear? I think Bear is another good one. Bear Notes. But there's that. And apps, like digital apps that help supplement or streamline the user experience. I think that's it. There it is. I finally got there. I think the whole thing is a conversation about user experience and why people are like finicky about digital versus print, right? They feel, for the people who fight for print, they feel that print is the better user experience for them because they understand how to open a third of the book really easily. They have the assumptions like, of certain artifact tools.
Yeah.
And they have a physical thing to hold on to and they feel like they are using it properly because they immediately find the information that they're trying to find without pressing too many buttons, I suppose.
Yeah. And versus like trying to learn digital, it's like, oh, you know, control F, magical. Highlighting stuff, writing up your own notes, which I'm sure people do in like what Microsoft OneNote and Google Docs and stuff like that all the time. Could you even sell a game as a Google Doc, right? Like, yes, I know you can sell the Google Doc thing, but could you like build a game around the concept of backlinking in a Google Doc as well, which is really fascinating?
Technically, I did for a while for Navathan because one of my higher tiers on my Patreon is that you get to see the live documents of any game that I'm working on. So you get to see the process. You get to watch me actually like type
do
in
the
real
thing.
Time.
Yeah.
And
type back at Pam going, babe, help me.
Yes.
Or see my comments of like, that's fucking sick. Or, I don't know what we're going to do, but that's sick.
Or my comments of like, I accidentally okayed a revision without properly reading your note.
Help I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like that was actually, or rather, that is one of the benefits of one of my Patreon tiers, that you can kind of like see the live document. So none of them has been out for years.
Heard that. But I really do, now that I've gotten my head towards this thought direction, I really think it's all about user experience. I think this whole conversation relies on the big topic of user experience when it comes to a tabletop role-playing game and using it as a reference book, right? Because oftentimes that's what it is. It's a reference for something you need to look up. Otherwise, you don't need to look in the book, right? And it's also the user experience of the character sheet or the dashboard. How does that user experience on digital feel versus print for a lot of people? It's and it's also user experience also includes like the events of things, not just the usability of things, right? So some people probably fight for print, like you said, physical dice. It is a ton of joy to hear it, to see it, to be on the ride with a D20 that won't stop spinning. It's disappointing you roll a D4, right? Because it just clumps on the table. It's fun to write. Mm-hmm. It's fun to erase. You're using your body, right? How do those things transition? What's fun about the digital space is the user experience, right? It's being a master of your reference. It's being a master of your knowledge. It's being able to like find the process that gets you to the information quickest, right? It's all the cutting out the fat of the process. At least for me, when it comes to digital, it's about writing up those notes and then having the best process to get to and from different pockets of information that I'll need at any time on my lore document or whatever have you. So aside from, there's additional, it's not just user experience. I think a big part of it is that, but the other conversation is accessibility to materials and infrastructure when it comes to digital versus print. As you were talking about earlier, that your shipping infrastructure is, from what I'm hearing, triangulation garbage. And
yes, basically non-existent.
Those are my words, but your feelings. And it is unfair for the purchasers to support the hashtag RPGC, but be very, you know, it's the same things when corporations do pride stuff, right? It's like, they're rainbow
essentially.
Washing, right?
It's so performative.
Thank you. That's the word. I couldn't find it, but thank you. Performative for sure. It's like, yes, RPGC, but we still want our and let me put, I've mentioned this on the show before, but let me put something in perspective for someone who may be new here. This is your first episode. Let's talk about how much D&D 5e actually costs. In a perfect world, you're at a table of five people, four players, and one DM. The DM's guide is $50. A player's handbook is $50. The monster manual, $50. That's $150 for D&D 5th edition. Now, all the rules are in the player's handbook, for sure. So you could only buy that and be satisfied. However, at some point, you're each going to want your own copy. So that is at least five copies of the player's handbook, totaling to $250. So if you were to get all three books for your group of five people, you're spending $350 at some point for D&D 5th edition. It is not a $50 game.
Oh, don't forget. Official supplement.
Sure, I want all those juicy subclasses. I want my Tasha's Cauldron races bullshit, right? My race rewrite. I want the new, what did they just come out with? The
Radiant Citadel.
No, the Mordenkainen's thing that like...
Oh, that thing. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the patch update. Right. Gotta buy the patch update, dude.
Uh-huh, that's true. Yeah.
So...
And then you gotta look up the errata...
Yeah, so when Game's End is, you know, a $100 book, that might be okay, actually, because you might need only the one.
Can't even imagining, like, charging $100 for a single book.
I wish we could, is the thing. But, like, we only charged $25 and people were already struggling with that.
Yeah, wow. You know, this is what I've been observing with them's analytics for the past few, like, weeks since we launched. And I'm not going to bore you with numbers, but literally the system that we have right now is that for every two payments, I put up a community copy. Mm-hmm. And this is more because I want to make it sustainable for me and Pam, where we earn something, but we also give back.
We also give back, right? Yeah.
And beyond that, we also have to remember that we had 935 backers during the Kickstarter campaign. So that's potentially 935 people within our networks and circles that will now no longer need to buy the $25 current cost of Navithem's End on itch. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, and this is like, I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. I happily give free copies of the book to people who want to review it, for people who cannot quite afford it, for people who were part of the design journey, like my artists, I give them all free copies. Mm-hmm. So there's that too, right? And so every time I release like 2, 3, 5 community copies, within the hour and even less than, they're all gone. And I've never had a game have this sort of behavior on itch before. Mm. So for me, my interpretation of that is they can't afford the $25 cost. So they're waiting for community copies to come up. And when it does, they eat it all up. Mm-hmm. Because that's what they can afford. They can't pay for it, so they wait for the community copies. And that's the point of community copies, right? Mm-hmm. But is Navithem then too expensive? No. That's where my head goes, right? Like,
no.
But, like that. But that is the thing, right? Mm-hmm. We had to go on sale for the first like 2 weeks after launch because I wanted to see how much we would sell at a lower price point
versus
the current price point. Mm-hmm. And ever since the sale ended, we've not had a single sale. So, right?
Yeah.
They wanted at a lower price point. Like, the data tells me I should lower prices. You know what I mean?
No,
but
me
if
and
I
my,
price this,
me and my
we
partner,
won't have a profit.
She is a photographer. And I think this is a very interesting like coupling in here. Mm-hmm. She's a photographer and she charges about 3 digits worth for like a headshot, right?
Right.
There are some photographers who do what are called like mini sessions every once in a while. It's like a little sale thing, right? Mm-hmm. And the mini sessions are like $30 or whatever have you. You get like a headshot, you get a couple of snaps, you get one outfit change, whatever. Whatever the metrics are don't really matter in this particular example. Mm-hmm. The issue with capitalism and consumerism is that we're trained to look for deals, right? And especially in more artist-driven or creative-driven industries that don't have like a tangible objective use outside of like entertainment and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The consumer has been trained that like this industry is, I'll say it, low-key desperate to like make funds on games. And so they wait. There are people out there who know that when your initial bulk of sales are done, you will try to sell more games because you need that money. You're hungry for that dollars and you're still working on your other projects or whatever have you. So there are legitimately people who probably have the mindset strategy of like, this will go on sale eventually. When it does, I'll purchase. And then the second you do that, you have also shown people that, oh, it can go on sale, so I'll wait for the next sale. The same thing happens with my partner. The first time she did the mini sessions, people are like, oh, I'll just wait for it. Like, they're like, hey, all right, do you do headshots and stuff? I see that you did like some mini session things over here. Yeah, I'm currently not doing those. You know, my full photo shoots are this amount of money. That's all right. I'll just wait for the next mini shoot.
Yeah, yep.
And that's tragic. That's absolutely tragic.
Yeah.
But it also shows that those people didn't need it that bad, right? Which is an unfortunate conversation to have when talking about Nabathim Zen is like, oh, I don't need it that bad. If it goes on sale, I'll get it, right? Which is not a fun thing to say, but like that's how they're thinking, right? It's like, oh, it'll be fun to have, but it's not something like I'm dying for. I think the community, the fans that are like dying to have the game are the ones that are going to pay the price point. I talk about this all the time with my creative friends as far as like a business end of stuff. Is a perfect example is we do a dog service out here called Rover, which is house sitting, boarding, whatever have you, for cats and dogs.
Aww.
Yes, I watch a lot of puppers. We actually have a meeting tomorrow for one, and we're starting another one.
I want a hug from a dog. Anyway, gosh.
So, you know, you look at the market of your area. I live in the greater Cleveland area, so I look at what everybody else is charging. But I also charge based on my income. You charge based on your international rights for your more proper services, right? Like outside of the game for all your design pieces and consultation. So what I've learned is that the people who want something cheap will buy the cheap things. The people who have the money for the services you're offering will buy from you. So our boarding rate is $75 per night for the dog to be here. And
I don't have reference. Is that competitive or is that like expensive?
It is expensive for the area. Like I would say the next closest is $50 or something like that. So like
$10
the price. Yeah.
So
the reason I charge that is A, I'm thinking about the 20% that the Rover app will take from me. So I'm not really making 75. I'm actually making like 67 or something like that.
Right.
And then I also, because I'm my own business or freelancer or whatever, I have to think about taxes at the end of the year, right? So I'm also losing another potential 15% of that. So I'm actually making is 50 expendable dollars that have to go to other things like rent or food or luxuries if I can afford them, right? So what all those examples are to say that like A, Nabathim Zen could probably be more expensive. B, there are people that if you get like a good marketing push or something like that, and like just the right person finds you or is really interested in what you're selling, they're going to buy it. They're going to buy it at that price, right? I think that the quote that always sticks with me, it's like from some cheesy self-help financial business guru kind of thing. But I think what is true about it is you don't need 10,000 customers. You need 1,000 true fans. 1,000 true fans are 1,000 people who are willing to spend $100 a month on whatever you're selling, on whatever you're giving them, services, products, whatever have you, right? And you can even, you know, we're an industry that plays in tens and hundreds, not really thousands and millions. So if you could find 100 people, right, that are willing to buy $50 from you every month, that's $5,000 a month. I'm speaking US. I don't know what the Filipino currency is, but $5,000 US, right? A month for 12 months. If you can find those 100 people, you're good, right? And you're able to charge what you want to charge. So I know it's such a tough thing to be like, I want Nabathim Zen to be affordable, accessible. I want to be at a price point that people who are in the games industry or who are game consumers will purchase. But there are board games out there that cost $400, $300, $120, $180 with expansions that are another $100, right? We just talked about how D&D 5th Edition is a $350 game at the end of the day, not including any supplements. So like, I don't know, it's your game and it's your own situation. But for me, I never think that you should charge less. I always think a person should charge more because there are people that can afford it in, you know, the European monstrosities that are US and UK, which, by the record, I would totally consider the United States a European country as far as I'm concerned. That, you know, we spawned from that. So
and like that's all like wonderful and stuff. And like that really should be how things are.
Yeah.
But and I guess that's also why, I mean, that's kind of why we're doing this podcast, right? We're trying to get more people to
understand.
To understand what Nabathim's End is, that it's fun and it's actually worth the buck.
Yeah.
And that's why I am staying up at ridiculous hours sometimes, or waking up at ridiculous hours, because I am helping to like facilitate like actual plays.
Because for them, it's a completely reasonable hour at their time zone. But for mine, it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, but
it's
I need to be there
right now per this recording. It's noon here, midnight there. It's goofy.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, you a part of that, like the whole never comes and it's worth it, and you just have to find like your audience and etc. But what a lot of people, and I think what a lot of designers also have to kind of reckon with, is the legwork mm-hmm. that it takes.
Yeah,
you are one of, I think, 30 people that I contacted day two after launch of Navathem's End, where I was like, hey, would you be interested in talking about this game on your show and whatnot? And like, I sent a lot of messages to people. I sent emails. I sent Twitter DMs. I sent a lot of things. And I sent like free copies and all that stuff in an attempt to help market the game. And, you know, not a lot of people know how, not a lot of people know how to do that. And I'm not saying I'm some great guru. I also don't know what I'm doing. And a lot of people get particularly burnt out by that kind of stuff. I've talked to a lot of people who have just...
It's a whole job.
...fizzled out.
It's a whole job. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm not complaining too hard.
No, I'm complaining. I'll complain for you because marketing is tough. A lot of
people, it is. It's super tough.
It's super tough to be at the grind every, you know, canvassing a neighborhood, right? Just on your feet. Uh-huh. Imagine that, doing that every day, the door-to-door salesman life. Now imagine doing that on the internet where people can have like really intense amenity about like, they could just easily ignore your message. They could
just forget. Or forget.
Or like give you the
and
the,
you,
like,
you,
oh, you're not big enough or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
like,
yeah, exactly.
I'll throw up. I'll actually throw up.
Like you have to make them feel like it's worth their time.
Yeah.
You have to make them feel like it's even worth like a look. And I've had a lot of people ask me, do you have a quick start guide or do you have like something for me to look at first? And I'm just like, I have 230 plus pages.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to turn that into a quick start.
I get it.
As much as I want to make a quick start guide, the whole thing about that also is, where am I going to find the time? Am I just going to reuse art assets? Is that okay with my artist? How am I going to market that?
Yep.
And where do I put it? Should it be a separate itch.io listing? How do I market that part? Is it going to be free? Is it going to be like $5 less, $10 less? Like how much is it going to be? The whole point of a quick start guide is that people can get it and plug and play, right? But then, like, that, say, from 230 pages, you make a quick start guide that's, like, maybe 20 pages. That's still 20 pages that I will have to lay out on my own because I don't have the money.
Distilled from the 200.
And, like, I don't have the money to pay a layout artist. I don't count on the goodwill of every single friend of mine to be like, oh, I'll lay out for you for free. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just a lot of work to put out something cheap.
Yeah. Because
then you have to also consider how much itch.io takes out.
Yeah.
You have to consider how long it takes for itch to even process your payout, which is about 10 days.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Actually, the most complicated part about itch.io's payout system is that each payout can only be paid out after a week. So, for example, if you're running a sale that lasts for a full week. You have to wait 1 week after the last day of your sale to actually reap the full profits of said sale.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
So if your sale runs for 10 days, you're not earning anything for those 10 days. And then you have to wait for another 10 days for itch to pay you. And that's 20 days. That's more than half a month.
Yep.
Rent's coming. My bills are due.
That's a whole goofy topic in of itself. The money transaction area, finances. Uh-huh. Well, Pam, Sin, we are at the 2 hour mark for this, which is one of the longer. Yeah, it hasn't felt that long. I promise. I've had an absolute blast. And I know that there's more that we want to talk about. I know that there's some stuff left on the table that we could extrapolate more and more. But I think we've done a really good job here today of talking about, A, this beautiful produced product of AAA quality that people should respect and purchase at the value you set it for, because that's the work you put into it, and the plight of digital versus print, because it's a true issue, and I think there are some things we can try to do to solve it, and I think there's some recontextualization that needs to happen for those who mm-hmm. are in a strong status position as far as European culture is concerned. Mm-hmm. So once again, could you just give a brief outro of who you both are, along with any links and resources that people can check out to find out more about you and where to get Navathan's End? All these links that they're about to give us will be down in the show notes for your access, listeners.
Okay, so I guess I'll start. So once again, I'm Pam Ponzalan. You can find me at Dovetailor. I'm mostly on Twitter, and half my life is on FF14, the critically acclaimed MMORPG.
With an expansion,
et cetera, et cetera. I don't remember the whole damn spiel anymore. But if you find me, great. Maybe I'll carry you, or you can carry me, because I'm currently progging Savage right now, and it is half my life. What other things are there? I do have a lot of games on sale. I am free for freelance commissions and whatnot. My current big project, now that Navathan's End is done, is the Dagger Isles supplement, official under Evil Hat for Blades in the Dark. You may also find my writing really soon in D&D's Journeys Through the Radiant Citadel. You can also purchase, if you want to check out some Filipino-inspired horror, Hunter the Reckoning, because I did all the Filipino-inspired content there. So that's me.
Hi, this is Sin. I am Diwata Manila on Twitter. You can find the game on diwatamnl.itch.io/Navathan's End. And I am basically Diwata Manila for everywhere, Patreon, Ko-fi. Yeah, you can find me on those places. I do lay out if you want to hire me for it. Although my commissions are currently closed, I'm so sorry. I'm trying really hard to pace myself. But if you want to see my portfolio, it is diwatamnl.card.co. If you want to find out more about Navathan, we do have a website. It is navathanrpg.com. So there's that.
Awesome. Thank you both again for being here today. I hope everyone had a wonderful time hanging out with us, because I learned a lot, and I hope you did too. And we'll catch you next time. Say bye to the people, Pam and Sin.
Bye.
Perfect unison. Love it. And that will be a wrap. Hey there, listeners. Thank you very much for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Pam, Sin, and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes for getting in touch with Pam and Sin and other content with similar topics. Support Jeremy and the DYD podcast by reviewing the show or joining the community Discord server. Thanks again for listening, and remember that design is a marathon, so enjoy the journey and have a great day.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.